Tem um ião.
Mora.
Ok, tu. Okay, there's a question in the chat about the grade for the design step of the project.
Professor, I'm not hearing you. I don't know if it's just me.
I think it's just you. I can hear him well.
Yeah, also yeah. I can hear him well.
Thanks. So there is a question about the grade for the steps of the project. You will have the grade in the end after the the last part, the implementation. There's no. You mostly all of you mostly did quite good. There are better projects than others. People with maybe more involvement, but the in general that's okay. What you have done. I have a few generic comments for the. Let me find my notes. Yeah, I have a few generic comments. Some of you, in fact, several people didn't realize that the CO2 column in the dataset. Let me show you that. So you have to be careful because the CO2 column in the dataset in the mission table. That the emission per person per kilometer. It means to know the amount of emissions, you have to multiply that number by the distance for that mission, right? So you have to get the emissions for a specific mission, you have to take that number and then to find the place using the place ID. Go into the place table and then retrieve the distance there and multiply that by CO2. Okay. And then you will have the emission for that mission. If you look in the table, the CO2 column, there are very few different numbers because it mostly depends on the transportation used. So it depends on if you are using a car or a plane or a train. So there are just a few distinct numbers there. So the main variations will come from the distance and from this factor too. But in fact, it's mainly from the distance. Okay. And in fact, the CO2 is here you have the how it's computed. If you use a public transportation, then you have this value. If you use the car, then you have this value, and so on. Okay. So you have to do you have to be careful about that. Also, there are many propositions, many designs where there is either no overview. So starting right with the question, or no access to the details. So your visualization, your designs are aggregating a lot of data, but only showing, for example, a bar chart with 5 bars or 10 bars. Then you cannot access individual informations through that visualization. So you have to consider also this question. Can we remember the InfoVis mantra, overview first, then zoom and filter, then details on demand? So you have to consider the fact that people should be able to access to the details using your visualization. And then also, the last thing I wanted to say about that, that's something you couldn't think of before without looking at the data, but you will see that the distribution for most of the value is not something uniform. For example, the remember I think I provided a visualization for the emissions by the users. I don't remember where it is. Is it online somewhere? Yes, probably. And this distribution is not uniform at all. You may have problems when using linear scales that a lot of value will be contracted because they are quite low but still different, and then the high value will compress all the low values and making it very difficult to have a look, an interesting look at the low values. So you will have to deal with that either by one classical solution for that is to use log scales. But when using log scales, you lose the perception that they are way larger or way smaller. So you have to find a balance between that. But using log scale at least will allow to still have hints on the low values, for example. So that the cumulated distribution function, and you see for half of the users, we have very low values of emission. So here, the goal for this curve was to show that they are very low values. But if you want to add some information, for example, the transportation mode or the ranks on the title of the people, if you want to add that, then you have very little space on this graph to add this kind of information. So you have to think of it and maybe choose log scales for quantities like tons of CO2 or even anything. There are many things distributed like that. So the emissions, the number of mission, you will find people with a lot of mission and few people with a lot of mission and a lot of people with a few missions. So that's the kind of distribution which is not uniform, and you have to find a solution for that. Okay, so that's the four remarks I had for you. And there is a question about the names. The names are not unique. What is unique in the same, I think, that's specified, not sure, I will check. If you look at the user, the name is unique for a given house. Okay. So it's not a unique identifier. If you want a unique identifier, then you can rely on user ID or the combination of name and house. So if we are using names in our bar chart, what can we do? You have to, if you want something unique, you have to take the combination of name and house. And anyway, the name is not that relevant. It was just to have something you can read better than the user ID. If you want to have something unique, you have to to use a name and house like you would have a forename and then a first name and last name, for example. Then that will be unique. Okay. It's unfair to compare the carbon footprint with the footprint. Yeah, that's a good remark. The fact that depending on for how long people have been in the lab, there are solutions for that. You could focus on a specific period, but you can also do some kind of computation to look at the emission per year or per days abroad or per you can do some kind of some compute some attributes from the original attributes. For example, one other example is you can compute the amount of emission for one mission, and if this mission lasts for only 24 hours, then if you do a full round trip to the US just to be there for 24 hours, maybe it's different in terms of ecological responsibility. Maybe it's different than going abroad for 6 months, for example. So you could also compute the amount of emission per day or divide that by the time abroad to have some sense of how reasonable it is to take a flight just to spend 24 hours somewhere or to spend a whole semester or somewhere. That's not the same thing. So you have to consider attributes that you can compute from the raw data that I gave you. Okay, so let me go back to the lecture. I will switch that off. Share this one. Okay. Here I am. So last week we started the part on graphs, networks. So we define graphs. Look at various problems that we can have with linked data. So first, the layout of the nodes. Usually, we don't have the place for the node is not given, so you have to compute one layout, and this is a tricky problem, even in one dimension. So we saw different approach to that problem for node links diagrams. And then we saw another problem, the fact that so we have on one side the layout of the nodes, and on the other side we could call that a layout also, but for the links or the edges, because in a node links visualization, as you know, in networks more broadly, the number of edges grows faster than the number of nodes, so the number of vertices. So when the network is quite dense, you will have what is sometimes referred as the hairball problem. So you have a lot of links, and it's difficult to read. So solutions to that, we have seen edge bundling, where people try to group together edges so that the structure, so you lose some information, but the structure is simpler. So hopefully you can grasp more insights from the links. And another approach to solve the same problem is edge compression, where instead of just displaying the network, you compute some other structure, which is referred there as a power graph. So the where the nodes are not only single items, single vertices, but you group vertices in different classes, and then you can factor out some links. And then what you have seen last week is that, of course, interaction can come to the rescue, and hopefully by designing clever interaction, then it will be easier to make sense of such dense networks. Okay, we were there, and then we started the part on another possibility when visualizing networks, and this possibility is to use the adjacency matrix, which is often seen as a something more abstract, like a table. But in fact, this table can be used to as a visualization, right? And the idea there that we will use rows and columns in the table for the vertices, and then the edges will have some kind of representation at the intersections of the rows and columns. Right? So we started with this example of the characters of the Les Misérables and their interaction, so that it can be seen as a social network with the nodes being the characters and the links being the relation between the characters. Okay. And remember, the color are the chapters of the book. So that was a node link layout generated using a force directed layout. Remember that. And there we have an adjacency matrix used to represent the exact same graph. Okay. And we have the same encoding for the colors, where the colors are the chapters of the book. And what was interesting there is that we can see some patterns. Remember, we have blocks along the diagonal, like that, and like this one. And if you go back to the node link visualization, you will quite easily find out that, in fact, those patterns are clicks, or mostly clicks in the graph. So the green one, what is it? Oh, not sure that the same colors, because the green one, that's not a click there. Okay, I will have to check that, but I don't think that the same colors used on the graph. And another pattern, remember we have some character here that is connected. So we have this cross pattern. So that's a central node for some definition of centrality. And that's a click. Okay. So we can recognize patterns. Of course, there is a catch there, and maybe you thought about this, maybe not. The catch for the click is that it relies on having a good order. There you have to choose an order for the node, right? An order, in fact, that's a layout. That's a layout in a one dimension. Okay. So when we have a click, it appears as a block along the diagonal because the members of the click are together, are grouped together in this order. If you shuffle this order and if you spread the different element of the click along this dimension, then the click won't be a block like that. You will have a pattern, but it will be harder to recognize, and even harder when mixed with other patterns, because the pattern for a click will be some kind of a regular grid. Okay. I think you can figure out that. That's also a click. So if you have something like that, if you have a regular grid in your matrix, that's a click because those guys are connected to those ones. Okay. So having patterns rely so being anyway being able to recognize patterns makes the assumption that you have an order which is good to show the patterns. And basically, that's if you use, for example, the alphabetical order or any order that is arbitrary, then you won't be able to see the patterns. That's not totally true. For example, the cross there for a very central node will appear somehow, but you have some local central node. For example, there you have a cross-like pattern, but only in a subset of the graph. And this one, if you shuffle the the nodes, you may not be able to see that. Okay. So reordering, having a good order for the for an adjacency matrix is something really really important. So once again, we have a layout problem there, and finding the best possible layout is something quite complex because you know that when you have a number of nodes, you have to explore all the permutations, and all the permutations, it's a very large number. And as soon as you add some rows or columns, this number explodes. Okay. So there have been several approaches to this problem of finding a proper order. And in 1967, so you may think I make a fixation about Jacques Bertin, but he was really a pioneer in this information visualization area. So Jacques Bertin explained that this problem of ordering can be solved by the eye, by looking at the data, and especially by manipulating the data. So what he proposed that as a method, that method it's called la graphique, so the graphical method. And let's have a look at this example. So in this case, the matrix is not square because it's a bipartite graph where only nodes are connected. You have two sets of nodes, and some nodes are connected in one set are only connected to nodes in the other set. So we have the two sets of nodes on the two axes, and we don't need the whole matrix because it's mostly empty, right? Just to be sure, when you have a bipartite graph, so nodes from this part are connected only to nodes to the B part, and it means that you will have only connections in those area, and the two diagonal blocks there will be empty. So if you have something undirected, which is the case there, all the information is contained into this part of the adjacency matrix. And that's why we have some rectangular matrix there. And what Bertin did was to print somehow the matrix and then cut the rows and reorder the rows by making rows that looks similar together, right? And then at some point he pasted that and took a picture and then printed the picture and then cut the picture into columns. So he started with the rows and then columns, or the other way. Reordered the rows and columns and continued like that. And he did also other operations. For example, there you can see you have some connections going on in this part, but not there. But you have the same kind of distribution, but with a negative part of each other. So he allowed some transformation, like taking the complement to some lines or columns. And that's noted by adding a dot there, saying that this part there should be considered as the opposite. And then you have some visual patterns like that. And he continued like that and called that process diagonalization. Okay. And so he did that by hand before the advent of computers, of course. What's interesting there is that this method was documented, and I will show you after the lecture. I will send you some links, but I will show you that now some excerpt of videos of the method by Bertin, because they have a colleague of mine made the work to put them online. So there is a first video which is called Bébert et la graphique. Bébert, like Robert, so that's a nickname in French. This video is there to explain the method. So I will just show you. So that's Jacques Bertin playing. There are two characters in this video, and he's playing the naive guy, and another guy will explain you how to go through the process of diagonalization. And it's a bit funny. It's intended to be funny. I will let you watch it. It's quite interesting. Looking at the picture, you will see that we are in the 70s in France. People are drinking wine and making some preparing some something to eat, and having a nice conversation about how to optimize when they go to do the shopping at the market for the vegetables and the meat, I don't remember, how to optimize the places of the retailers on the market. So here you have all the retailers, and there all what they are selling. The idea is to put together the different retailers. And so they start by reordering the okay, maybe I can show that. Okay, that's the end result. And then you will show the process for that. Okay, that's a bit later. So that's the reordering, okay? Okay, you show the swapping of the columns and the swapping of the lines. Okay, and that's the end result. Okay. Then there is another video which is not captioned in English, but which is interesting because it shows a real data set and how they worked on that data set. So here you can see hopefully, I will put the video from the, so they have the data on paper and they are constructing the matrix there using some pieces. Some are white, some are black, some are, in fact, we see them as gray, but in fact, it's a pattern of black and white. And each pixel of this visualization is put together by hand. I think there is a closer shot there. Okay, you can see. So they built first some, they call that domino. So that's a piece of, I don't know if it's if it were plastic or, and with some pattern printed on it. And then they use that to code the values. Yeah, you are lucky with these three, sure. So they are building the visualization. Okay. And then for the reordering, they use, it's not easy to see, but they use some sticks because the pieces have some holes in them. And they use some sticks that can traverse the visualization. And they use that to move some parts. So there he splits the visualization in two parts. And then it does some reordering of the columns of the lines. And then you can do that in the other direction. Okay. So of course, that was a very slow process. And then that's an animation because they took pictures at each step of the process to explain it. Okay. So that's a stop motion animation of the reordering process. Yeah. Okay. So I will send you the link so that you can have a closer look at that. And you can see a picture there of way larger matrices like this one. Or this one, which is even larger. Can you see this one? Yeah, and you can see the camera there to take picture of the result. Okay. So I will stop there for the work by Bertin. And what is interesting is that, so he showed that you can do some manual reordering using what he called a graphical method, which is, okay, judging by your perception, you will put close together things that are similar, okay? So, and it tells us that with a proper encoding of the rows and columns, then similarity will be, will pop up to the eyes, which he doesn't demonstrate that. There is no proof of that. And it's a really empirical method, right? Of course, there are many other methods to do to compute some ordering. And in many science fields, people had struggled with doing some ordering of a linear ordering of items, depending on some kind of metrics, if they are similar or not. And there is a review there of many. In fact, it's called a matrix reordering method, but in fact, it's mostly how to compute one-dimensional layouts when you have items. So there are automatic methods that you can use. For example, remember the dendrogramics example. So the tree that was showing also the similarity matrix of elements, and to compute an order, we used the clustering of the elements, and then had only to look for the possible orders through the permutation of the tree. So that reduced considerably the search space for a good order of the node. It's only a squared number of the number of elements rather than having something exponential. Right, where am I? Okay. So here we have some examples of how ordering has been used. That's an example. In fact, I put that in the adjacency matrix, but it really is a table where, so you can consider that when you have a table with the, so that the cars, remember that the data set with the cars in lines, and then the columns are the values attributes. And you can see that any table, you can see that as a matrix, in fact. You could see that as a bipartite graph where you have the items of your class, your regular data table are some nodes. The attributes are some another set of nodes. So you have some bipartite graph, and the connections are something having some values on them, right? So any matrix visualization can serve as a table visualization, and that's also that's true the other way around if your graph is a bipartite, right? So in this case, you can see that at the intersection of a line and column, the links are encoded using usual visual variables like the length there or the color and position. So you can reuse what we have seen in the first part of the lecture there in each cell of the table. You can reuse that and do some encoding there. Right? And then to see some patterns, you can sort according to one column or to one specific we usually use the columns in this kind of table, but there you can see that it has been sorted using the origin by grouping the three different origin for the cars, and then most probably using the that the MPG I don't remember, but it's mostly sorted according to that criterion. And then maybe you can see patterns. For example, low MPGs implies high cylinders and the displacements and so on. Okay, so that's better than just having raw numbers. It's not a scatter plot. It's not a, but with this kind of visualization, you can see patterns already. Here we have the same ideas. Yeah, so using a visualization in the cell of a table, and what's more what is original there is that so it's really a table, but when adjacent cells have the same values, they are grouped together. So you can see patterns and you can see structure in that table. I won't say much more about that. That's just another example of table visualization. We'll have a look at the kind of patterns that we can see on adjacency matrices. So remember, if you have block along the diagonal, that's because you have part of the graph that are connected together and only together. So that's those examples are patterns where you have no default at all. But of course, in real data, so if you have that, you have only clicks. But in real data, you will find out that there are missing connections, or that you have a connection outside the patterns. Right? Real patterns look more like that. So you have something like a click with missing elements, and then another thing that looks like a click, and then you will see that you have some connection outside of the pattern. Okay? But if you have blocks, then you have a really strongly connected component in your graph. If you have off-diagonal block patterns, we have seen that right before, it means that some part of your nodes are connected to other parts of your graph. And the fact that this part there and this part there is empty means that you have a bipartite graph, right, with a node. So that means that you have some nodes. If we use a node link representation, number so that there's no confusion. So you have some nodes. And you have connections only between nodes from one group, so that's A and that's B, and two nodes in the other group. You don't have connections inside the A group or inside the B group. So that's called a bipartite graph. Okay. The other kind of pattern that you can have is some line or star pattern, and then that's a central node. Okay. Of course, you can have things with more nodes involved, then you will have something central with other elements. You can have bands like that, and it means that your network has a specific structure. In this case, if we look at something more simple, so if we have the diagonal there, and if we have only connection off the diagonal by, let's say, one, it means that we have a structure where the nodes are connected to the next one, something like that. You have a chain of elements. Right? You can have some noise. It doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have structure, because the noise can be just an artifact of the ordering. So all those patterns, remember, are only visible if you have a proper ordering. So if you find this kind of pattern in your data, something noisy, then you don't know if the network is just random, or if you have some structure that you are not able to see. And what is interesting is that some algorithms some ordering algorithm will, so they will find an order. Even if you have no specific structure in your data, they will find an order. And you can produce patterns like that. And in fact, if you have a good layout algorithm applied to random data, in fact, you will have this kind of structure, and it will only show that, in fact, that the signature of that the footprint, sorry, of the algorithm rather than the structure in the data. Because in fact, the connections are quite random. If you look at the distribution of the connection there, you cannot tell anything. If you construct the graph, you will see that in fact, there's no structure in that. So some absence of structure, if you feed that to an algorithm that try to do some ordering in the node, can lead to some, and that's why it's called anti-pattern, to a visual pattern, which is in fact has no information in it. That's only, in fact, if you look, the nodes are sorted according to the number of connections they have. So this one is a node with three connections, this one with two, then nodes with one connection are put there. Okay. And that's it. So it doesn't tell you anything about the structure of the graph. So before going into that, so those patterns are highlighted in, I'm going back to the layout, in this publication. So they study the different many reordering method, and they highlight which method is the most capable of highlighting specific patterns in the adjacency matrix, so that you can choose the proper algorithm depending on if you are more interested in seeing the blocks in your data, or more interesting of seeing if there are some kind of bipartite graph in your data, and so on. You can use different algorithm to depending on what patterns you are looking for. Okay, and they also show the kind of anti-pattern that are produced by the algorithm, so that you, if you see this this thing that resemble to some structure in your data, you can compare that to the output of the same algorithm applied to some random graph, to just to check that you are not only seeing some byproduct of the algorithm. And the last thing about the networks visualization, you may wonder, okay, now we have two ways to visualize graphs or networks. We can use some node links diagram, or we can use the adjacency matrix approach. And which one should we choose? Is it just a matter of aesthetics, or are there any other criterion to choose between two? And in this paper, which is quite old but still interesting, the authors there did an experiment to see what each visualization are good at. Okay, so for that, they first proposed a list of tasks that you would be that you should be able on graphs on that that interest you. For example, some tasks are following paths, finding if there is a connection between two nodes, and if yes, which is the shortest path between two nodes, or tasks like when you have a node, find the neighbors of that node. So they studied many tasks like that. They generated some graphs, And they provided the visualization, and they they showed that to users, and they measured their performances when performing those tasks in terms of success or failure, but also in terms of time spent to perform the task. So I won't go much further into this paper. I will give you this paper to read, because even if it's quite old, what is interesting there is that you will see how to such evaluation can be performed. So preparing some tasks that are rather abstract and having people perform those tasks with two systems and then comparing the performances. And that's one way to somehow prove that a visualization is efficient, or at least is more efficient than another visualization. This question of evaluation, we won't have time to speak more about it, but it's something quite tricky in visualization, because to evaluate the visualization, a specific visualization, you have to show that it's better, or it can to it's better to another visualization, or you have to be able to compare between two visualizations. But in visualizations, you also have the interactive part, and depending on how the interaction is implemented, can also change a lot the outcome of the evaluation. And when you do such kind of evaluation involving real people using the visualization, that it's just not, it's not just a matter of you have the data set. It's not just the visualization technique. The performance depends on the data set and the visualization technique, of course, and on the user. So and what you want to be able to measure is the performance of the visualization. So depending on the task and the data set and the user, you will have a mix of effects that you want to distinguish, and you want to just know the effect of the visualization technique itself. So it's something really tricky, and I'm not sure we have a good way to do that. Anyway, so the conclusion for this paper is that for small graphs, so small in terms of the number of nodes, nodding diagrams are more readable and more familiar than matrices. So what in the paper you will see, small graphs is really small. It's like 10 or 20 nodes, something like that. Okay. For larger graphs, the performance of nodding diagram deteriorates quickly, while matrices remain readable. Okay. So people have to learn the matrices, but once they have learned how they work and what the pattern look like, then they are able to read them. What is interesting is that the results, so you will read the paper, but the result depend on the kind of tasks. So if your task is to find so for large graphs, the matrices are better than nodding diagram, except for tasks like finding a path. And that's quite logical, because in an adjacency matrix, when you want to know if two nodes are connected, then if there is no connection, then you have to go through all the connection and then go there, go back there, and then look if there is a connection there. And doing the hops through the graph, it's something really costly, because you have to go from inside the matrix to the set of nodes there, and then jump through the other dimension and then check for the other connections. And that's something really difficult to do. Right. And then So you may remember this example. In fact, why not? Since we know matrices are good at some tasks and Nodling diagrams are good at other tasks, why not try to mix them together? And remember this this visualization technique, so called knot tricks, and that's exactly what they did. Okay. And if you look at the author there in 2004, so Jean-Daniel Fekett, that's one of the senior researchers there. So he did that work, and then a few years later with his next PhD student, Nathalie Henry, they did that work, mixing both kind of visualizations. Okay, so that's it for networks. And now we will jump to trees. So trees, you can consider that that just a specific type of network. So anything that we have seen before can be applied to trees, but we have some specificities, and the main specificity is that you have a tree when in a network, you have a single pass that goes from one node to another node, okay? So any pair of nodes that you choose, you will have a single pass between them. And that changes a lot of things because in fact, it's a kind of network which is by construction less dense than a typical network. Because if you remove a single link, a single edge in a tree, then you have two trees. Okay. You have two connected components. So any edge is a connection between two trees. Okay. So there are specific things that you can do for trees. So let's start with a definition. So a tree is a directed acyclic graph. Directed, maybe you can drop that constraint because you have something directed if you have a root in your tree. Okay. But if you consider that any node can be the root, then you have something undirected. And acyclic, that's the property I just explained. Okay. How to encode that? You can go back to a single table to encode a tree. And what you will need is to have one column with a unique ID. So unique ID, it means that something, something nominal, right? And another column that refers to that unique ID and that gives for one node the parent of the tree. And in fact, in this column, what you have there is the edge, the edges of the tree. And since for a single node, you have only one parent, you only need one column. Okay. And that's why you use for edges, you put the edges on the vertices and you put the connection to the parent because you are sure that there is a single connection. And then as with networks, you can add some attributes. Okay, and you don't need a second table because whether the attributes apply to the nodes themselves or to the links, because you may want to add some values onto the links as in a regular network. But still, since in the table for in one line you have one vertex and the link there, the attributes can be in the same table. They may apply to the link or they may apply to the node itself, but you can still put them in the same table. So what makes trees specific is that you will have new tasks and some are related to the hierarchy of the trees. For example, you may want to find the parent, the children, the siblings of the node. Some are connected to subtrees. You may consider, you may be interested in the size of subtrees, in their width, in their depth, and so on. Or to, like in networks, you may want to find the path between a different node. And as with networks, we have two main families of visualization. So we put aside the adjacency matrix because we could use an adjacency matrix for trees. But if you look at the structure of a tree, if you want to use an adjacency matrix, you will find out that it's really not efficient because, so if we have our nodes like that, A, B, C, D, when you have a tree, you know that for each node, there is a single connection to the parent. So it means, so if we have something like that, it means that B, the parent of B is A, so we have something there. The parent of C is A, the parent of D is B. And having a tree means that on a single line, you will have only one cell, which is filled, okay? Because that's the definition of a tree. The nodes are only linked to their parent. Okay, so you will have exactly one connection per line in your matrix. So that's a waste of space. So basically, the adjacency matrix is not is really not a good idea. When you have something a bit more complex than a tree, than a real tree, for example, if you have some, if you allow some. Some thing like direct acyclic graphs. So you have something oriented, but you can have a multiple parents for a single node. Then the connections, the adjacency matrix is a bit more dense, and you could consider using adjacency matrix or at least part of adjacency matrix, and there are visualization techniques doing that. But in a real tree case, that's not a good idea. So we still have node links diagrams, and that's probably a good use case for that because we the density of the links is not high, so we won't face the problem of having a lot of edges crossing anywhere. And in fact, if you have a tree, you can always do a layout without edges crossing. Right, that's a property of trees. But we have another interesting visualization technique, which is based on nesting nodes inside each other. And we'll see that if we have time today, if not after the holiday break. So for node links diagrams, we have the same challenges than for the networks. So we have to first find the layout for the nodes, right? And there are many ways to do that. And since we have less constraint with the edges, and since the edges give us some structure, because if you choose one route for your tree, then you have a new matrix, like you can tell the depth of the elements that will be the distance to the to the root, and you can use that as a metric to compute your layout. So there, for example, all the nodes that have the same depth are laid out onto the same vertical place. Okay, so that's one possibility. And then still, you will have to find the horizontal position for the nodes. And there are many ways to do that. Okay, in this case, the layout is quite simple. So the vertical layout, in fact, if you look at the leaves of the tree, they each have their position along the x-axis. So it means doing a tree traversal of the leaves, you can assign to each leaf an order, and this order is used for the vertical axis. And then the parent of any node is placed at the center of the position for the children. Okay. The center of the position for the leaves, for example, B is exactly at the center between E and K. Okay. So it's easy to explain. It's not that easy to code. If you have some time spare, coding a tree layout, it's something not that easy. And in fact, this one is quite naive. You can do it in a linear time, and it's tricky to do it in linear time. No, maybe this one is easy to do in linear time. But if you want to be a bit more smart than that, for example, you can see there that we have a lot of empty space in the middle there. So you may want to put this subtree closer, or this subtree closer, since even if you put them closer, this one, C node, will still be readable on the graph. So you may want to compress this layout depending on if you have an empty space to put closer the different subtrees. And in fact, there is an optimal way to do that. So you can compute a layout with the smallest width, and computing that is quite tricky. And the algorithm to do that can be done in linear time, if I remember well. But to do it in linear time, you have to be very clever. So if you don't know what to do during the holidays, you can look for that algorithm. Okay. There is a whole branch again of research in this area. Laying out trees is something that has been well studied, and that is with still things to do in this area. On the right, you may wonder how this tree has been laid out, and in fact, that's a circular layout. So that's exactly the same algorithm, but in polar coordinates. A is at the center, then C are on a circle at distance one. And then we have another circle with the nodes at distance two, and a last circle with the nodes at distance three. And the leaves, again, so G is a leaf. H is the leaf, E, L, K, and C. And you can see that we have also the leaves are at equal distance in angle, and then the parents are in the center of the subtrees. So that's the exact same algorithm there, and you just have to take care of since you have angles, you have something periodic there. There are some edges to consider, but it works the same. Okay. Right. So once you have a layout, you still have to encode the node, and you still have to encode the edges, and then you have the whole design space that we have seen before. If you have attribute on the nodes, attribute on the links, then you can use the color, you can use the shape, the size, and so on. Right. Okay. And the main question then is how to use efficiently the space, and especially when you have very large trees. And I will show this example. It should work like that. Okay. So that's a YouTube video. So that's a system from 2002. The video is quite dark. I will send you the link for the video. And what you see that again, so I decided for this technique because that's an example where interaction is interesting. So you click on nodes and then they expand ahead to show what are the children of a specific node. Okay. What is interesting there is that for each node that is not expanded, you have a kind of triangle there. And this triangle has three graphical properties. You have the width of the triangle, you have the height of the triangle, and you have the value. You have the gray level. This one is black and this one is gray. And in fact, those three variables are used to encode information about the subtree. And it tells you how wide is the subtree, how deep is the subtree. And the value gives you the number of nodes, because you can have a very thin trees. So that's a mix of, it gives you some information about the shape of the subtree and also about the number of nodes of the subtree. Okay. And so that's a vertical layout, the root is there. And what is interesting, so you can expand, but also, if there is not enough space to expand the, so we'll see an example. There, this subtree is open, and we want to explore this one. And then the algorithm, when we will expand this node, the algorithm finds out that there is not enough space to expand this node, so it will collapse this node. And to do that, and that's one first example of that, you will have an animation, so it seems trivial to do that, but at that time it was not that easy to perform animations. So this part of the node will collapse, and then it will fade into a triangle explaining what is the shape of this subtree, and the other subtree will then be shown. And in between, the layout will change slightly so that the tree is positioned for a better appearance of the subtree. So first, we'll the collapse, then the expand, and then, there's no animation step in between, but in other cases, you will have an animation in between. So here you have a collapse and then an expand. Here we'll just have expansion, I think. That's the explanation about the shape for the triangles. So the links for the video that are in the slides, but I will also put them for easier access on the lecture page. Okay. Okay, we'll stop there for this demo. And then, that's the next one. Next demo, this one, quite old, so from 1996. The idea there is that the layout of the tree is done in an infinite space, but this infinite space is transformed using a mathematical transformation into a finite circle. And for that, they use an hyperbolic projection to do that. So the layout of the tree uses some regular standard tree algorithm in an abstract space, and this space is then projected into a circle. And then again, I will show you that. Okay, and you can see that in fact there is an horizon there, so those nodes are far away than the node in the center, so the distances are as you go closer to the circle, as in fact you are going to the infinity. Okay, so the nodes become smaller and smaller, and in fact you have an infinite space, but which is compressed towards the border of the circle. So you can lay out infinite trees, but then you will be able to see the details only in the focus region of the circle. And again, there are interactions where you can change the center, the central node. Okay, I will skip to that part. Okay, so when you go from one node to the another, in fact, you are what you are doing is you are panning in the abstract plane where the tree is laid out. This panning induces with the projection onto the circle induces some transformation. So there are nodes appearing from some parts or disappearing towards the horizon and other parts. And again, for the trees that cannot be shown, you have some hints telling you how large they are and how dense they are. And you can add some marks, so some graphical encoding on the nodes, and so on. Okay, you have a Xerox logo there because this work was done at Xerox Park. Oops. Right. And maybe a last one. And I show this one because that's probably the most cited work in information visualization. And this work, that's a tree layout made in three dimensions. So you have the root of the tree, and then the children are on a circular plateau there. And then subtrees are laid out into circles on each level. There. So you need three dimensions. And that's interesting because this dates back to 1991. So the graphical power of computers were not that big at that time. So that's one of the first use of 3D into visualization. And I think this paper is cited a lot because that's one first of this kind. And if you read the paper, that's amazing because at that time they did not need to prove anything about the visualization. They just did the visualization and say, okay, look, that's cool, we can do that. And this paper is so this conference, CAI, is one of the highest level conference in the human computer interaction. So Robertson, McKinley, and Carr, that's a guy that did a lot of impressive work. But this paper, there's nothing in it. I mean, that's just an idea. But there's no proof that it's useful. They didn't even compare it to just a regular 2D layout. They didn't make any study to show that it works in the sense that it's useful. And in fact, it does not work. People can't use that kind of visualization because there are a lot of occlusion in this visualization. The interaction is terrible because you if you are interested in something that you see, you can't even click on it. You have to roll the plateau to go there and so on. So that's a terrible example of visualization. And I show it because it's quite iconic of there's a difference between having something that you can do, doing it just because technically you can do it, which is appealing because at that time having something in 3D was like futuristic, but in fact it doesn't work at all. And if you compare that to real simple visualization, the real simple visualization will be far better than this. Okay, so that's a kind of warning for you. Don't look for things that are, you can do it, but you have to know what you are doing. If you want to have something efficient, it's not the same thing as having something which is just nice looking or that will provide some wow reaction. That's not the goal when doing visualization. But still, they succeed because this paper, you can look at the references to this paper. I think it's the most widely cited paper in information visualization. So that's a lesson to learn, maybe. Okay, so that's it for today, I think. Yes, that's it for today. We have just a few things to see about the nested layout for the last lecture that will happen after the holidays. During the last lecture, what we will do also is to, you can have a look, remember, on the webpage of the lecture, if I go back there, you have the subject of the past exams. So during the holidays or after the holidays, you can go through those subjects and have a look. And I think during the last lecture, so we'll finish the part on trees. And if you have questions about the exams of the past year, we will take some time to answer your questions and to make some to clarify anything you any question that you could have about it. Okay. So that's it for today. That's it for the week. That's it for the semester. That's it for the not for the semester yet, but for the year at least. So I hope you will be all safe during the holidays.
Professor?
Yes?
I have one question. As I send you email, it was not, I think, clear for you. I missed the first time that when you explained about the project. So first about the data set, it is mandatory we have to choose carbon data set or no, because I went based on tectonic data set.
I will answer to your mail more thoughtfully if you want. Okay.
Okay.
There was a more general question about if the exams will be remote or in person. Unfortunately, I'm not sure that we don't have an answer for that right now. Okay. So you will have to have the head of the master program. I have no information for that. I know that in other years, we we plan to do the exam in person, but I don't know for the. Are we cross course for with MCM? No, we are not officially. So when following MCM, you are allowed to follow this lecture, but I don't think I'm in the informatic visualization is in the official cross courses. But I guess that it will be the same. From my point of view, I think after the holidays, pandemics won't be in France won't be better. So I would guess that there will be a remote. But honestly, I have no idea, and you can't rely on what I'm saying. So you have to wait for the instructions from the head of the master. Yes, the project is 34% of the final mark. Okay. And this 34% is split into 10% for the first part, 10% for the questions, 40% for the designs, and 40% for the implementation. Okay. Okay, so
Professor, can we use other tools and like languages to implement?
Yeah, there are instructions. There are precise instructions. So you can use blah 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 blah. If the tool you are planning to use is not explicitly in the list, you have to ask if you can use it. Okay, so answer to that question,
Professor. Like DEMPL, other packages of JavaScript you can use, yeah. DEMPL or DTRE.
You have to add that by email so that I can have a look specifically, because I don't know
I already sent email. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So hope to see you next year. I wish you the best for the last of 2000, and I hope that 2000 and 2001 will be. Better for everybody, and I really would be happy to see you in person, even if it's for the exams, but or for the last lecture. But I'm not that optimistic for that. So. We'll see.